KaiserNetwork.org.
This is Larry Levitt from KaiserNetwork.org. Welcome to Ask the Experts, our regular interactive web show that provides in-depth discussion of current health policy issues and allows you to interact directly with the nation's top policy experts. On November 15th, open enrollment for the Medicare prescription drug benefit begins. Over the next 6 weeks, seniors and disabled beneficiaries will sort through dozens of private plans and consider their options for the first time since Part D coverage began earlier this year. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, a new Democratic majority is poised to push for changes in the program. To look ahead at the landscape for drug plans, the options for Medicare beneficiaries, and these policy issues, we're joined here in the Kaiser Broadcast Studio by an exceptional panel of experts. Leslie Norwalk is Acting Administrator of CMS, the agency overseeing the Medicare and Medicaid programs. Judy Stein directs the Center for Medicare Advocacy, which counsels Medicare beneficiaries. And Juliette Kubianski is a principal policy analyst with the Kaiser Family Foundation and lead author of an upcoming article in Health Affairs on Medicare Part D enrollment. You can reach our panel of experts in two ways. Email your questions to ask@kaisernetwork.org or call us here in the studio and ask your question on the air. You can phone toll-free at 1-888-KAISER-8. That's 1-888-524-7378. And thanks to all of you for joining us. Leslie, let's start with you. Give us a sense, moving into this open enrollment period, of the landscape of choices for beneficiaries. How are the plan choices and premiums changing from last year?
They're not that dissimilar from last year. Now, some of the plans themselves have moved around a little bit, and which is why it's important that beneficiaries pay attention to what they've received from the plans they're currently enrolled in for 2006. We've asked them to send out something called an annual notice of change, and that delineates the changes that they may see in their premiums and their deductible and so on and so forth. And it's important that they take a look at that because we want to be sure that they're happy with what they see in 2007. Now, more globally, we've seen that plans paid attention to what beneficiaries liked in 2006. One of the things beneficiaries liked was no deductible. So we have more plans offering no deductible options, which is important for beneficiaries. We've also seen an increase in the number of drugs that are covered on formularies. Again, beneficiaries want to be sure they have access to certain prescriptions, and so it's the plans have responded to that.
And these are the lists of approved drugs that the plan will cover.
Right.
The formulary.
Exactly. Yeah. That's right. The list of approved, that's a good point, in case we have anyone out there who isn't in drug speak, so you will. I think the other important point is that a lot of beneficiaries have options of a lesser premium. I'd like to focus on the fact that while the premium is one indicator of cost, it really isn't the entire indicator. And beneficiaries should take a look for what they do for 2007. Take a look at that annual notice of change. Determine whether or not they've had any changes in their own health status. Maybe they're taking new prescriptions or are off others. And do another look, because the fact of the matter is they may need to make a change between 2006 and 2007. So what we say is prepare and compare. If it turns out that you don't need to change your plan because you're satisfied, the customer service has been good, the cost is not dissimilar, or you're happy with where you are in terms of cost perspective, and it's still convenient, you can still go to your pharmacy. If you don't want to make a change, doing nothing will mean you're in the same plan between 2006 and 2007. So you don't have to do anything. But beneficiaries who've taken a look, and we encourage them all to do so, if they decide that something needs a change, they can go ahead and do that. And their disenrollment from their first plan for 2006 will turn in and will automatically happen as they enroll.
So it's a one-step process.
One-step process.
And anything unexpected in the...
Nothing in particular that's unexpected. I think that some people in certain plans, there are some significant changes, so they really do need to take a look. But most plans, I think, overall, pretty even keel, other than some of the enhancements that have been made, and those enhancements are good for beneficiaries. But other folks may see some changes that they'll want to take another look and make sure that what they do for 2007 is right with what they need.
Great. And Judy Stein, you're sort of on the front lines of Medicare and counseling seniors and disabled beneficiaries. What types of questions have you been hearing from beneficiaries? What types of concerns have you been hearing them express?
Well, we're still finishing up dealing with some of the questions around premiums being withheld from Social Security, which weren't intentional, people being enrolled in a plan and then finding somehow they're no longer in the plan. And we have had problems getting these problems fixed in real time. They're taking quite a bit of time to get resolved. But as we look into 2007, one of the things I certainly agree with Leslie about is that everybody needs to reconsider what their plan is. Originally, some of of the press releases from the secretary indicated that if you were happy with your plan, you could stay put. And I think that it's very good to have CMS echoing our message, with it, which is happy or not in 2006. Part D, for better or worse, is a new program every year. And so every year, people need to look again. And what we're finding is that, indeed, some of the plans are quite different. And, for instance, some of the plans that have the largest market in the country no longer covers brand drugs in the gap like it did.
This is the donut, what people refer to
the donut hole, that second deductible gap. If we have one client who we did a plan finder tool for who was getting coverage for her about $1,527 worth of brand name drugs during the donut hole, and those won't be covered at all. That's a person from Texas. Someone from Connecticut will also have the same problem. So if an individual is taking advantage of coverage from their current plan during that second coverage gap, largely for brand name drugs, they really want to look again because those drugs are unlikely to be covered in 2007, and there's no need to pay for that additional coverage. Usually, coverage during the donut hole will only be for formulary drugs. And another thing is we're finding premiums often higher, so they need to look at that. The lowest cost program in Connecticut, for instance, is more than twice as expensive in the coming year. Further, just because a plan calls itself complete doesn't mean it's actually complete. That is, don't be taken by the words, look, is there coverage for your drug? Is there coverage during the donut hole? The deductible being a zero deductible is nice because you get upfront coverage, but it's worth $265 in 2007. So try and figure out what you're going to be spending to get that upfront deductible. And finally, understand that even if the drugs you expect to take are on the formularies, you need to look even further than that to see whether there will be utilization management tools applies. And by that I mean a prior authorization required from your doctor, the requirement that you try another drug called step therapy before the drug on the formulary that you need is covered, whether there's a dosage limit, quantity limit. So you need to look at a lot of things beyond the premium and make sure that if you've benefited from brand name drugs being covered in 2006, that you don't just assume that will be taken care of in 2007.
And what would you say? I mean, people don't live for analyzing their personal drug coverage. I mean, if seniors or disabled beneficiaries had to take two or three steps, I mean, two or three things to look at in this process, what would you say those would be?
The first would be to look at the plan they are on this year, happy or not, and see what it looks like for the coming year. Is it identical? If it's not identical, then figure out what you think you can afford and look at plans in that cost group to see whether the drugs you know you need are going to be covered and for how much and whether you'll be required to have any of these co-payments or prior authorization or dosage limits if you need those drugs.
Yeah, Larry, just to give you a sense of what CMS is doing, and this is actually something that we do with the Center for Medicare Advocacy, among many other state health insurance assistance programs. They're one of our many partners to help reach out to beneficiaries. But let me give some simple steps so beneficiaries can understand exactly what they would need to do. The first is get a sense of what all your prescriptions are, whether you bring the vials to the phone with you or if you use the internet, bring them to your computer. Once you've done that, either call us at 1-800-MEDICARE, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Log on to our website at www.medicare.gov. I bet your listeners or viewers actually know how to use the web. And medicare.gov, same information you would get if you call us. We can send you, or you can look on the website, to do a comparison, taking the drugs that you use, the pharmacy that you use, where you live, and so on, and we'll compare all the plans in your area that are available by cost on an annual basis. We've done a lot of improvements to our web tool this year, which are really great. One of the things that we found most necessary is beneficiaries often have a difficult time conceiving of what this donut hole is all about. And what we've done is we've put together a bar graph or a chart that says this is what you would spend in month one, month two, month three, month four, and so on. So a beneficiary can plan and see what it means in terms of premiums and deductibles at every single month along the way. So if you have a deductible like the $265 that Judy mentioned, what will your outlay be in that first month or second month while you're in that deductible period? Then if you've got coverage, which you would have for the next however much it is, depending on your drug spend, then you'll hit the coverage gap and have a second deductible, unless you're in a plan that fills in that coverage gap, there are still options available for Medicare beneficiaries in 2007, although you're right, those options have changed. They're offered by different companies now. So the graph is available for beneficiaries to help them, and that can help them be comfortable in the choice they make. Now, whether you use the Medicare.gov tool or you work with folks in Judy Shop at the Center for Medicare Advocacy or, frankly, any of the other state health insurance programs that are out there, our partners, our website, and our phone, we can provide these tools. If you give us the names of the drugs and the name of your pharmacy, we can tell you what plan is right for you based on your usage, which is an important tool.
Julia, let me bring you in here. There has been a lot of public discussion of the donut hole or the coverage gap. How many people are we talking about who might be at risk of falling into that gap?
Well, there was an updated analysis prepared for Kaiser by the Actuarial Research Corporation that approximately 4 million beneficiaries are expected to have spending in the coverage gap in 2006.
So that's maybe about 10% of beneficiaries?
That's about 10% of the total Medicare population, right.
And what we've been talking a little bit about how coverage of the donut hole might mm-hmm. change this year, and plans have a fair amount of flexibility in how they establish their right. benefits. Give us a sense of some of those changes, I mean, what you're seeing in plans.
Well, basically, there are more plans available in 2007 that will offer some coverage in the gap. Primarily, that additional coverage is for generic drugs only. So, as was mentioned, there's been a change in terms of the plans that are offering full coverage for both brand name and generic drugs in the gap, with only about 1% of plans available in 2007 that'll offer that full coverage. So it's definitely something for people to be aware of if they're currently enrolled in a plan that's offering that complete coverage that might not be available for them from that same plan. If it's important to them to have that comprehensive level of coverage, mm-hmm. they'll need to shop around.
Mm-hmm. And this varies from place to place, and there's typically you have to pay a higher premium to get,
absolutely.
To
that's
get
right.
this additional coverage, but
that's
it's
right.
but it's an option for people.
That's right.
Some people.
Yes. I think all beneficiaries, with maybe there may be one exception, I'm not sure if it's offered in Alaska, but I think for 2007 that nearly all beneficiaries will have an option for brand and generic coverage in the gap. It's just not offered by the same company. And you're right, Juliet, that we've seen significant numbers of plans now offer, significantly more than 2006, mm-hmm. offer at least generic coverage in the gap. The interesting thing about the prescription drug benefit in Medicare beneficiaries is that they take more generics than the rest of the population, and that the percentage of drugs that they take that are generic are, from at least what I have been hearing anecdotally, well over 60%. So it's not insignificant that coverage in the gap is being provided because a number of Medicare beneficiaries take advantage of that wherever they can. And, of course, as more generics come to market, it'll be more important.
What do you think that might be? Is it maybe the history of less drug coverage on
I think they're smart shoppers. I think the plans have done a lot to promote them, certainly, and they're very cost conscious and are very concerned about their out-of-pocket costs, perhaps more so than those of us who are in the under 65 population that have insurance through an employer, for example. And because of that, I think they're very concerned about where their dollar is going, and they feel comfortable with generics for whatever reason in a way that is somewhat different from the rest of the population. But I think it's encouraging that a lot of plans recognize that and are offering coverage for the gap, at least for that particular segment of prescriptions.
Although I have to say that I find that most of the people who call us who have very high cost drugs during the year are dependent upon brand name drugs. People who have a cancer or cardiac problem, Alzheimer's, these are fortunately new drugs and they're not generic yet. You know, we had a call from someone from Virginia today whose costs were $157 a year to her last year because of the coverage for the brand name drugs as well as the formulas on her current program. And doing a plan finder tool, we found that this coming year, if she stayed on that plan, it would be $5,900. So it's very different. I actually think there are 11 states where there's no coverage for brand or formulary drugs during the second deductible, the donut hole gap. And as I said, this woman who we spoke to this morning, as well as others who need brand name drugs, really will not find the assistance they need. Finally, I think it continues to be the case that Medicare Part D requires a new look every year and really one-on-one counseling. And that is a problem for the likes of me and my staff, which need to deal with literally hundreds of thousands of people who need assistance in looking to make a choice. An example of the kind of people we're talking about, I brought a postcard I received last week, and this woman writes, please send me the latest info about Medicare card. She really means the new program. I'm 86 and poor. You helped me before. Thanks again. I have no computer and no one who will. Can you mail it to me? And it's just a huge challenge to deal with the needs out there and the need to look in our lab state of Connecticut, which we consider our laboratory. It's small. We only have 51 plans, and we get inquiries from all over the country as well. People like Mrs. B here need a lot of attention and help, and that is one of the real challenges of the Medicare Part D program.
Well, speaking of attention and help, let's go to some of the questions from our audience. We have a caller on the line from West Virginia. Caller, please go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi.
Yes, I had a question regarding the formularies. With the exception of medications that are removed from the market or some situation like that, can a plan remove medications from their formulary during the plan year?
Yes,
they can. That's a good question, caller. For example, whenever it is that there's a safety issue or a black box warning or the FDA puts something out, I can think of a number of, at least one example last year, we would expect the drugs to be pulled from the formulary immediately, particularly where there are safety issues for beneficiaries. Those drugs should clearly not be covered. There are a few other instances. There really are a few other instances where a formulary can change, where they might pull the drug off ultimately. But typically, that requires notice to beneficiaries. There was a lot of concern last year about bait and switch.
Exactly.
So one of the things that we've done is we've actually done an analysis of all the formulary requests that came in at least in 2006 in terms of changes, and saw that most of them were because of a safety concern or a generic became available, and they actually either moved the brand name drug off the formulary or more likely to a higher tier. We've taken a look at a lot of this because we want to be sure that beneficiaries aren't tricked into something. So we actually approve all the formulary changes that are considered negative or disadvantageous to a beneficiary. But most of them we've seen really do relate to a generic becoming available or a safety issue of a drug that's currently on the market.
And let me ask you, because we had a similar question about formularies by email. And this one says, in 2006, Medicare issued a guidance that required plans to include all or substantially all medications in six classes, including antipsychotics, antidepressants, and anticonvulsants. This was further defined to mean all of these medications within a class. This policy is important because switching these medications can be risky. Will this policy remain in effect in 2007?
I think it's still substantially all for two. It's the same. We have exactly the same requirement for 2006 as we do for 2007. And all the formularies have gone through their approval process. This happened actually in April or May of this year. And that's exactly what we required. We appreciate that those six classes, I think you missed those drugs that help treat HIV/AIDS, right, transplants, and I can't remember what the sixth one was. In any event, very, very important for beneficiaries to have access to these prescriptions, and consequently that we have not changed our rules between 06 and 07.
Larry, if I could comment on some of that.
Sure.
With regard to the formulary changes during the plan year, beneficiaries, as Leslie indicated, have to get a 60-day notice prior to the change being effective. This is one of the places where I would really love Congress to take a look, because I think that there should be parity between the ability of the formularies, the plans to change their formularies, or change the amount the beneficiary might have to pay to get the drug, the copay, or the tier, as Leslie referred to it. Sometimes those copay increases are significant enough to make a big difference to the beneficiary, or to require prior authorization or step therapy. If that can change every 60 days, I think that individuals who've enrolled in the plan ought to be able to change plans if whatever that change in the formulary is significant enough to them so that the plan no longer meets their needs. And finally, with regard to the substantially all the drugs. There, too, sometimes we found that the drug would be covered, but it would be subject to one of these utilization management tools that are prior auth or a copay higher than the norm. And that is something people need to look at. It can be an impediment. And that's why we need to look beyond just, is it covered on the formulary?
Yeah, Judy, I think you raise a point that's important for people. And first of all, it's important for people to know if they can only call us that we'll send them exactly the same information that they could see on our website. So just because you don't have a website available to you, that doesn't mean that we won't give you exactly the same information we will. But one of the things that we've included on our website is the prior authorization requirements. Is there utilization management? Is there step therapy? It is important for beneficiaries to know what it would take to get a particular prescription. Not only that, we've put it around customer service issues. How have they done on certain things? And that will be on our website tomorrow so that beneficiaries can take a look. If I have a problem and need to call the plan, how responsive are they? So there's a fair amount we've actually put out there so that in one stop, whether it's our website or phone number or going through our thousands of partners, they can get the information they need in one place to provide the most comprehensive look at what plans make sense for them.
Let me ask you about the phone number, 1-800-Medicare. We had an email about this from a reporter in California. It sounds like you all agreed that everyone should look at what they have now and mm-hmm. look at their options. This reporter indicated that the advisors at 1-800-Medicare are telling callers that they don't have to do anything if they want to stay in the same plan. Isn't it advisable for all Medicare beneficiaries currently enrolled in Part D to review their plan instead of just automatically renewing this?
Yeah, I think it sort of depends on what point in the conversation that happens at 1-800-Medicare. I mean, clearly if someone's calling, they want to take a look. So if they've taken a look and then said, I'm happy where I am, then they don't have to do anything. What we don't want is people to enroll in the exact same plan from 06 to 07 because it gives our computer stress, and they don't need to. They don't have to make that step. If they have done the check, as we call it, the prescription drug checkup, if they've done their checkup and they're happy, they don't have to do anything because we'll automatically roll them over. So I think it depends on how the question was being answered for that beneficiary. And it is, in fact, something that we're saying generally to people if they're happy after they've done the look, don't do anything.
But I think that caveat was not clearly stated in the beginning, and unfortunately, perhaps it's still in some of the scripts at 1-800-Medicare. I'm not certain, but I do know that the September press releases from CMS prior to Leslie's tenure were saying, if you're happy and you know it, clap your hands, stay where you are. It's not good advice. And frankly, I wish it was, because it causes a lot of problems for people and a lot of work for the helpers, because everyone does need to look again. And that's not the way Medicare in general works. It is the way Part D works.
We also got a number of questions about dual eligibles. These are people eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid, and the auto assignment process into plans. There are some cases where these beneficiaries, they have to enroll in lower cost plans in order to get a full subsidy, and those plans may or may not be available, or the cost may be higher. Leslie, could you describe how this process will work this year?
There are a number of different steps. The first thing I would say is that we took a look at all of the plans after the bidding process was finished and said, how many of these plans turn out to no longer qualify to have these beneficiaries enrolled at the full subsidy level? In a number of states, there were a few plans who no longer qualified. That translates into, I think it's about 288,000 beneficiaries around the country who would need to switch to a new plan. And that's actually something we have done for them if they hadn't chosen that plan to begin with. So there's a slight exception to that. But basically, we made the decision that first, most beneficiaries in this class probably don't want to be paying a premium. But some of them chose a plan and said, I want to be in that plan. We left it up to them. If they want to stay in that plan, great, they can stay in that plan. But we automatically enrolled everyone else into something new on a random assignment basis, just as we did in 2006. So those 288,000 beneficiaries, generally, they'll be signed up for a new plan for 2007. And those letters have already gone out. That's important for beneficiaries to know that, gee, you'll be getting a new card. Take a look at that. We've provided the information, or will be providing the information to the pharmacies as well through our automated system, so that they can see there has been a plan change for those beneficiaries. But we did a lot of things to try and minimize that particular disruption for 2007, not wanting to have to switch millions of beneficiaries again. It was awfully difficult in 2006, and we want to make that transition as smooth as possible for them.
And we had a question from New York about whether this applies to just dual eligibles, or is it also people who aren't necessarily eligible for Medicaid but are still getting a subsidy?
Right. It really applies across the board. And as I said, there is one exception, and many beneficiaries either chose a plan on their own or someone chose one for them. And if they made a particular selection, because for whatever reason, we let that selection stand. Now, what we're doing, dual eligibles always have an opportunity to switch plans on a monthly basis. So if they're unhappy with the plan we've put them in, they can move January, February, March, wherever. The limited income subsidy folks, actually, that's something that we are also allowing them to do throughout the rest of 2007. If they, too, want to make a change, they can make a change. So it does apply across the board, and even those who've chosen a plan and stayed in that plan, if they've got a slight premium and they don't want it anymore, we're going to let them choose at any point in time over 2007.
And Judy, do you happen
to know whether the numbers you cited for the numbers that were reassigned is the numbers whose are the sponsor is different or the plan is different?
The organization, so the sponsor itself is different. There are a number of individuals who are in exactly the same organization, but the plan itself, so they'll have the same network, they'll have the same cost sharing that they would have, but they may be in a different part of that organization, but it would look seamless to the beneficiary.
Yeah, but the coverage may be different.
The coverage would be the same between the two. We in terms of how that works out, we've asked that there may be an annual notice of change, and there may be a difference from one year to the next. But within the organization, even I think what we have been seeing, in fact, is coverage has increased. There are more drugs covered, not fewer. Yeah. But again, a lot less disruptive than moving into an entirely new plan with a new pharmacy network. Perhaps different, entirely different drugs. We didn't see all that many changes between 06 and 07, except for significant increase in covered drugs. But I would imagine that most of the utilization management tools are also similar from one year to the next between the plans.
One of the things I know, Larry, is that we in Connecticut are part of a Kaiser study that's being finished, reviewing what's happened to dual eligibles in three states, Connecticut, Washington, and Florida. Connecticut has a very substantial, what's called a wraparound. The state has paid a lot of money to make sure that people who are eligible for both Medicaid and Medicare are no worse off than they were prior to being
because
moved
the Medicaid
to
coverage
Part D.
Was more comprehensive than...
Yes, and the fact is that we didn't have a copay, for instance, and the formulary, the list of drugs, is much more comprehensive. So people in Connecticut were doing better on Medicaid than they are on Medicare. And the study is proving out that those states where there is such a state investment to keep the drug coverage equal to what they had under Medicaid, there's far less access problems for the poorest people than when there's no such wraparound. And I think this is something that we need to be concerned about and look at in the future to make sure that Part D actually is meeting the needs of our most vulnerable citizens.
And Juliet, do you know, is that common across states, that wraparound coverage?
I don't think that actually many states are really doing very extensive wraparound for the dual eligibles.
Yeah, it's correct. More likely to be seen actually in a population that is above that. So more states have state pharmaceutical assistance programs that are not for the dual eligible, but for those who are above that Medicaid income level category.
And those typically pre-existed
absolutely
before Part D.
And what we've done is work very hard. I think there are over 30, 35, 36 states, I think, that actually have those SPAP programs, as we call them. And they can be incredibly useful. Connecticut, in fact, has one for the population that's above the Medicaid level called CONPACE. So there are a lot of states that do this, particularly in New England. And if people are concerned, if they're reaching the donut hole and are having difficulties, it does make sense to take a look. Does your state offer this sort of assistance? We've been working very closely with the pharmaceutical manufacturers, asking them to consider extending their own patient assistance programs to beneficiaries who are on Part D. And we've seen a number of them. I think AstraZeneca just did one lately, and there are a number of others that have in the past said, okay, as long as they're in Part D, we'll in fact provide some additional coverage to them if they meet our income requirements. So there are, particularly if people are having difficulty with some brand name drugs, it's worth taking a look at the pharmaceutical manufacturers, because many of them now are starting to, or have in the past, cover Medicare beneficiaries even when they're on Part D.
Well, I want to turn, we had a number of emails about more policy-oriented questions as well that I'd like to turn to. And one concerns the number of new plans that you've seen coming in. And I'll read it. Why do you think that new sponsors are choosing to offer prescription drug plans this year, even though enrollment was heavily concentrated in a few large companies last year? Is there a viable business opportunity for these niche sponsors, or are they likely to be shaken out in the coming years? Were you surprised to see new plans?
A little bit. I think the overall numbers are only slightly higher. The plans that we saw, they've clearly done their homework. They offered, more plans were offered with no deductible. More plans were offered with at least generics being covered in the gap. They paid attention to where beneficiaries chose plans in 06. A few people sat out 06 and maybe wish they'd gotten in on the ground floor. So a lot of what we've seen where their new market entrance was a concerted effort to enroll dual eligibles so that they would have less of the marketing costs, but to really target their plans to ensure that they could cover that pool of beneficiaries to make their business model profitable or at least workable. I think what happens over time will really depend. I hate to guess the market. I think if you asked me when we were originally putting this together, we were all worried that we might not have two plans in regions. Well, we have more than two plans. So I think initially we were surprised. I'm less so now because clearly there is a way for this to work. And if you don't have sufficient numbers, CMS has been really diligent about wanting to ensure the customer service be appropriate and that the administrative infrastructure exists so these companies just can't have some plan and then not have the support that the beneficiary needs. And if they only have 10 beneficiaries, it's awfully expensive to cover those 10 beneficiaries with what we now require. So I suspect at the end of the day, there will be some shakeout. It may be a few years before it happens.
And Julie, yeah.
Sorry, I was just going to add on top of that, in terms of the expanded set of offerings that we're seeing between 2006 and 2007, one of the reasons I think behind it is that there are a larger number of companies who are offering coverage nationwide that may be only offered in either a handful or maybe half the states in 2006. And then we're also seeing some plans that did participate in 2006 expand their offerings. So they may only have offered one plan in a region last year, and this year they'll be offering, or for 2007, they'll be offering three plans. So to maybe give people who are enrolled in their plan a wider set of options.
And these national plans were quite popular in 2006.
Yes, the national plans certainly got a lot of the enrollment across the country in 2006.
I think that's not surprising because Medicare has historically been a program that allows you to travel throughout the country and you can count on getting your coverage. And so that's what a lot of people were looking for as they tried to get prescription drug coverage under Medicare. And also, I think, as we know, there were a few plans that took a very large market share, and they did that nationwide and also through enrolling a lot of dually eligibles. One, at least, of those major plans, we've had just this week problems with customer service where they said there was no one Spanish-speaking to take an enrollment, where they said that they actually didn't have a person licensed in the particular state to take an enrollment. This is for a dually eligible who should have been allowed to switch. We've also had some concerns where people are being told they have to have an agent come to their house, and that's not required. They should be allowed to enroll over the telephone. And we have been concerned about that as well as some other marketing concerns where it appears that there's a desire to help people move into managed care prescription drug when all the individual really wanted was to enroll in a prescription drug program. So those are a variety of the nuances with regard to the enrollments for the coming year.
We had a question from a reporter here in Washington about these marketing techniques. We've seen some interesting marketing techniques this year, including showings of Casablanca, where seniors receive materials about individual plans. Are you aware of any misleading marketing tactics or any abuses by any of the plans? And
yes.
Judy, you certainly talked a little bit about that. What's the process? I mean, how does CMS monitor?
Well, we do a lot of monitoring, and it's calls from people like Judy or, frankly, people calling us at 1-800-MEDICARE if they feel that they've been misled in any way, shape, or form. I'm not sure there's a whole lot wrong with watching Casablanca, but we are aware of a number of instances that give us great pause. There are a number of things that we're doing. Part of what we've heard about is some of the behavior of agents and brokers who actually may represent any number of plans. Now, agents and brokers are typically state licensed. So the, one of the first things that we do is work with the plan that had the problem, because sometimes the plans actually bring these things to our attention, or a beneficiary, but either way, ensure that we get to the state so that the state can take the appropriate action vis-a-vis their licensure. Whether it's sending someone, depending on the behavior, to the Office of the Inspector General to do further investigation, particularly depending on what it happens to be, offering beneficiaries something called a special election period. So, for instance, if they are not able, or if they sign up for a plan and feel they have been misled, we give them an opportunity to sign up for another plan, even outside the typical open enrollment period of this 6 weeks starting tomorrow. So I think it's really important for us to watch over this, provide notification for other plans who may use that agent and broker. We're putting together really an entire action plan that we hope to have in place in fairly short order because of these marketing concerns. But we really do need to be told. So if we're seeing issues, we want to get them addressed and addressed as quickly as possible, particularly starting tomorrow with the open enrollment season. Not that it is clearly a problem we want to watch year-round, but I would imagine if there's going to be an issue, it's going to really start tomorrow. And so I would encourage people to call us. There are 1-800 number operators have special scripts so that they can watch this, and we can do some tracking internally and try and nip this in the bud before many beneficiaries are misled. But we've seen things, television advertisements, that have been totally inappropriate in some states. So it is of great concern to us. Beneficiaries need to be told the facts, and that's one of the reasons we work so hard on our tools on our website, because they're very easy steps to watch, and we really include everything from customer service, as I said before, to formulary requirements and prior authorization tools, etc., so that everyone can have a level playing field at least to start with. So please, I would encourage anyone who sees these marketing abuses to let us know about it so we can address them as quickly as possible.
I think it raises one of the important points that people who are helping people as well as beneficiaries themselves need to pay attention to, and that is, as we all know, Medicare offers Part D coverage and Medicare in a variety of ways, and individuals can sign up for a prescription drug standalone plan and stay in the traditional Medicare program, and we've largely been talking about those plans. Or they can opt into a managed care plan which has prescription drug coverage, and that's called a Medicare Advantage prescription drug plan. Now, if they're in the Medicare Advantage plan, all of their Medicare coverage comes through that plan. And that's where we've seen some of the biggest problems, where an individual thought they were enrolling in a prescription drug plan and staying in Medicare, and in fact, they enrolled in a Medicare Advantage prescription drug plan.
And these are problems with marketing abuses, or problems with just people being confused?
Problems with marketing and the result. The problem with the marketing was this happened in senior housing, people whose primary language was not English, a person who was not literate. And Leslie is correct that we've actually been able on many occasions, and there have been dozens of these that we've handled, to get special enrollment periods and get these corrected for the individual. What we haven't been able to do is get systematic change so that this doesn't keep recurring. What happens is someone will find, for instance, that their home health aide was no longer able to come to them because that home health agency isn't in the managed care network, and that's how it came to their attention that they had signed up for managed care, or the physician wasn't in the network. So you need to be clear that you only want to sign up for the prescription drug program. If you go on to the Medicare website, a colleague of mine, husband, recently did, turning 65, and he, knowledgeable as he was, found that it was very hard to get out of the Medicare Advantage world and into prescription drug plan, which is all he wanted. So the marketing needs to be clear, and people need to know their own what they want, Medicare Advantage or just the prescription drug program. And then there should be some way systemically to take care of these, or maybe an action line or something, rather than just to repair each one.
And Leslie, this open enrollment period applies both to the standalone plans as well as the Medicare Advantage plan.
Actually, the Medicare Advantage plan, by statute, has a slightly longer open enrollment period. It actually goes through March. But if people want drug coverage, they need to make their drug coverage election this next 6 weeks, November 15th through December 31st. And in fact, that's a good opportunity for me to say, if they're going to sign up or if they're going to make a change, we would encourage that they do it earlier. December 8, don't be late, I think was the moniker I heard before I came over. And the reason we're asking people to sign up early is most, if you think about what happens, is lots of people go through insurance changes the month of December. I think the Federal Employee Health Benefit Program, we have to sign up by December 11th. That allows whatever the insurance company is to process the information and the paperwork, whether that's Medicare or a standalone drug plan or Medicare Advantage plan, so that on January 1st, you have all the paperwork processed, the beneficiary has the card, when you go to the pharmacy, you can get the drugs you need from the right plan. If you sign up on December 31st, it's much harder for that to happen, in fact, impossible on January 1st. So people should have that in mind in terms of expectations. The earlier you sign up, it should be much easier for you if you need prescription drugs in early January.
And do you expect there were reports of various kinds of glitches during the initial enrollment period last year? I'm sure you do. Yeah. Your expectations it'll be smoother this year?
Yes, we've done a number of systems upgrades. Still not perfect, but as I think Judy mentioned earlier on, we've had some issues with premium withholding. Where those issues have, the number of beneficiaries that are impacted have diminished to, I think, 35,000-40,000 people. It's still, one beneficiary is one too many, but we're working very hard to address those issues and clean them up on a systematic basis instead of on a one-by-one-by-one. So we're looking at really system changes where we have glitches, and it's starting a brand new program and enrolling tens of millions of beneficiaries. I suppose that we shouldn't be surprised that there are some glitches, but we have worked very hard to minimize them. And we're hopeful that for 2007, because we've set these systems up and been through this before, the number of problems that we have should be significantly diminished from what we saw. It won't be perfect, but I think it'll be much better.
Let me return to some of these policy issues, and we've got a number of emails about drug price negotiation, which is certainly a hot topic here in Washington these days, I'll read one of them. Why can't Medicare be enabled to negotiate reduced prescription rates with pharmaceutical manufacturers and distributors, as does the Veterans Administration for VA beneficiaries? And Judy, let me start with you. Whether this is something you support or oppose, what in your view is the argument for doing this?
The argument for it is that, like with the rest of the Medicare program, it would be more cost-effective and provide a more stable benefit for beneficiaries. Medicare, since 1965, has been a government-run program which negotiates, if you want to look at it that way, prices for all sorts of providers, hospitals, physicians. It's really a misnomer to call Medicare, traditional Medicare, a fee-for-service program. It kind of drives me crazy when people say that, because no one gets a fee for their service anymore. They get paid, but it's all by negotiated capitated rates of some sort or another, from the home care world to the physician world. In fact, physicians are waiting diligently with fingers about whether they'll be getting a cut from Medicare. So Medicare negotiates costs for their providers, and Medicare has been a tremendously successful public program since 1965. We had 50% of all people over 65 with no health insurance, and we have now 93% of all people 65 and older and people with disabilities who are insured. It would bring the costs down, and it would provide a more stable benefit, because we have seen that the experiment with private plans works when they're making a profit, and when they're not, they start to leave the market, which they did in droves in Connecticut. So I think that it would make a more stable and more cost-effective program, better for beneficiaries and better for taxpayers. And I see no reason why it should reduce the drugs available or the research and development, maybe some of the advertising and some of the administrative costs. But I think that it should be done.
Now, Leslie, in your current job, this would be you doing the negotiating. Is this authority you want?
Not really. There are a number of points that I could make about this, and the thought of Medicare, quote unquote, negotiating with, say, physicians is probably an unfair word to use. I'm sure no physician would say we've negotiated with them to cut their pay. The environment that we see this is somewhat interesting. This was something that I think people would be surprised to learn, that every bill before this passed, whether it would be democratically sponsored or sponsored by Republicans, had a non-interference clause, which is different from a negotiation clause. What happens really is all of these plans negotiate on behalf of Medicare beneficiaries. So we've talked around a lot of names today. We never mentioned any, which is frankly my approach. But these are the same people that negotiate on behalf of federal employees, for example. For my drug benefit, they offer a prescription drug plan. They cover 60, 70, 80 million covered lives, which is far more lives than the Medicare program currently has covered under the prescription drug plan now. So if people are talking about market power, well, there are lots of ways to look at market power. The other issue I would point out is that the Medicare program hasn't been all that good at negotiating prices for drugs. Our history in the Part B program, which is through the physician office, drugs that are administered there, is we used to pay something called average wholesale price. The other name for that was ain't what's paid. And in fact, there were lots of lawsuits where drug companies paid hundreds of millions of dollars because they did such a good job. The reimbursement for Medicare was so high for these drugs that they enticed doctors to use it, or at least that's the allegation, that doctors were enticed to use these drugs because their profit would be so great. Our track record hasn't been that terrific. The other thing I think it, there are a couple other things that I think it leaves out, is how Washington really works. Yesterday, I got a phone call from a congressman because on a drug that we do cover in a different setting, not in Part D, he was concerned that we were reducing the price of that drug, and he wanted us to increase the price. So this happens all the time in Washington. It's hardly a surprise that lobbyists play a big role in reimbursement, whether it's for a particular drug, whether it's for a power wheelchair, a home health payment, a hospital payment, or a physician payment. All of these are heavily lobbied. And when things, we have threats, oh, we're not going to give you any money, you can't implement that. That's the real environment. It's not as simple as perhaps the federal supply schedule, which the VA uses. And people talk about the VA price schedule a lot. One of the things, there are a lot of things that are different about the VA than about Medicare. First, VA basically controls all the physicians. So they say these are the 1,400 drugs you get to prescribe to beneficiaries and or to the veterans. And if you go off, and only very few of them actually ever go off formulary. But they're also provided through VA pharmacies. So the cost of the pharmacy and that distribution actually isn't included in the price of the drug. One of the things that you see in our plan finder includes both the negotiated price for the particular ingredient, that pill, but also the price of the pharmacy. And that is not inexpensive because pharmacies provide a very important service and they need to be paid for that service in dispensing the prescription. And they'll tell you that they don't think they've gotten a very good deal. Well, I've heard from many of them that they think that the negotiations, the plans have been too strong in their negotiating ability. So people often forget the distribution side of the house. And then finally, I point out, I'm not sure who of our wonderful employees we have at CMS, they're fabulous, but none of them really have experience in negotiating prices for drugs. What we would normally do is ask a contractor to do it for us. But guess what? All the contractors who are good at it are already offering plans. So I think from how this would actually be implemented is a lot more complex than I think most people have thought about it. It makes a great sound bite. Gee, they should negotiate because they'll save money. Well, the actuaries who are independent, they don't think so. The Congressional Budget Office doesn't think we'd save money. And in fact, the net Medicare costs over the next 10 years, down nearly $200 billion from their original estimates because the plans have done such a good job of competing and bringing the price of this benefit down. So I think the fact that we've done all that, 80% of beneficiaries are happy and 90% have prescription drug coverage in the first year, not too bad. Can the government do better? I doubt it.
Yeah, we had a follow-up question from a reporter, again, here in Washington, about the idea one way of approaching this would be to have a government plan competing with the private plans. And this reporter writes, some experts are pointing out that a belief in competition was what led to the current Part D construct, and that introducing another plan administered by the government would increase that degree of competition, leading possibly to lower drug prices and to greater savings for the government and taxpayers. In the administration's view, what would be undesirable about that outcome?
This is an interesting question. I've heard this talked about a little bit. One of the things that we learned, so let's take a look. What would it look like? What would this government plan look like for 2006? Let's just assume it happened. Well, we know it would have a $250 deductible because that's what Congress said. We know it would have a coverage gap. And we know the premium would have been about $37 because that's what the actuaries estimated it would be initially. I know that 78% of beneficiaries who chose a plan chose one with no deductible, 78%. So right off the bat, they aren't interested in the standard government plan because it has a deductible. Those who chose a deductible were likely to have chosen one that had a very, very low premium, certainly less than $37. So that must take, I haven't seen the numbers yet, I've asked them to actually check this out, but I will bet you that takes nearly most of the rest of the beneficiaries off. And then there are those who have coverage in the gap. So beneficiaries actually in their choices in 2006 did a lot of things that would tell us what would happen if the government somehow figured out how to hire the hundreds of people to negotiate prices for 4,500 different drugs in however many different pharmacies across the country. Because I'm going to presume I don't have anyone else I can contract this to. So we have some sense of what it would look like. And I think very, very few beneficiaries would be interested in paying a premium as high as $37 for a plan with a deductible and no coverage in the gap. So I think we have a good sense of what would happen.
And just, Tom, what's your sense, having seen how private plans in the drug benefit operate? And you talked earlier about the fee-for-service or traditional Medicare program.
Call it fee-for-service.
Yeah. what's your view of how that would play out if there were a government drug plan?
Well, first, with regard to negotiations, I know it's not simple. Nothing about Medicare is simple.
I have spent
30 years of my legal career understanding
that.
So we know that's not simple. Or someone at CMS told me if it was simple, I would have solved it a long time ago. But in any event, we do know that Walmart negotiates for Walmart, doesn't have each local store negotiate for its locality. And I think that is the model that ought to be followed for the 43 million Medicare beneficiaries. And I think that to say that we would have the Part D design, but just have a program that was government run, is not as creative as we would be if we had the opportunity to look at this afresh. The program as it is now, by its very design, has created huge amounts of complexities and costs because of the way it's designed. For CMS, I'm happy to say they consider us partners, for beneficiaries, a lot of those costs and complexities could go away if we had a model that was much more like Part B, where people opted out, not in, where everyone paid a premium to get the benefit, and where the benefit was uniform throughout the United States, at least as an option. And I think that would be more cost-effective, more stable, and provide just as more guaranteed coverage for people throughout the United States. And it is true that as he left office, Secretary Tommy Thompson said that he regretted that the statute had this restriction on negotiations. So those are two different issues with regard to a government plan and negotiations. But we need remember that Medicare is a government program. One of the most successful government experiments in providing health insurance for people throughout the United States. It's really been a tremendous success, so much so that people can't remember that 50% of people over 65 had no health insurance before Medicare came in. So all we wanted was it to also have a prescription drug benefit. That's not what happened, and that's what's being suggested now.
Well, I'm sure we'll have plenty of more opportunity to talk about this issue over the coming weeks. Just one last policy issue I wanted to get to, and it came in by email as well from New York. To what extent, in your opinion, is the large number of companies offering prescription drug plans in Medicare the result of government subsidies and risk-sharing arrangements? To what extent do you think this market will contract when these subsidies expire or if they were otherwise removed? And it's certainly another topic on Capitol Hill about these subsidies to private plans. And Leslie, what's your sense of how key these subsidies are and how the market is playing out?
There are two different subsidies for the drug benefit piece. Three. One is a subsidy for beneficiaries that the Medicare program pays 74.5% of the average cost for every beneficiary. And if you qualify for low income status, then in fact you get more than that. In order to have a robust participation, the actuaries tell us that piece, that 74.5% subsidy on behalf of beneficiaries, is really important. It's not dissimilar to what happens for Medicare Part B, which is the physician side, where we pay 75%. That, I think, is one critical subsidy. I'd be very surprised if anyone ever touched that.
And no one's really talking about that.
The two others, the next subsidy that people talk about is the fact that the Medicare program pays 80% of the catastrophic costs once beneficiaries reach their out-of-pocket limit. In 2006, it's $3,600 out-of-pocket. So once beneficiaries reach that, the beneficiary is responsible for 5%, the plan pays 15%, and the government pays 80%. I don't know if people – I actually haven't heard that people have been talking about removing that subsidy either. I think it's probably important because In terms of access to prescriptions, it's one of the things that the plans would probably need to stay around just to make sure that they can continue to provide that coverage. That is incorporated, by the way, when the actuaries figure it out, that's incorporated with a part of that premium subsidy. Now, the third, and perhaps maybe the most interesting, is something called really risk adjusting, or the stop loss insurance, that if a plan were to lose a lot of money, no one knew what was going to happen in 2003 when this passed. And so they said, we want belts and suspenders. We want the belt to be sure that if people have very high out-of-pocket costs, that we can cover those individually. But as an aggregate level, overall, we also want to have a subsidy if, or frankly, a risk corridor, because it's not necessarily a subsidy. If the plans lose a lot of money, we want the government to share in that loss. Well, the interesting thing is we also share in the gains. So the Medicare program will share in gains that these companies have. If it turns out that they made money and it's over a certain amount, Medicare actually gets to bring that money back and put it back into the treasury. Anecdotally, I've heard that most plans, at least the few that I've talked to, not most, but a number of plans I've talked to, think that they'll be paying Medicare back. So that, and that's at least for 2006. 2007, of course, we start all over again, and they think they've taken that into account as they change their premiums. That subsidy goes away in 2008. Because of the experience I've seen and the fact that drug costs have come down generally, if that trend continues, I would imagine that third subsidy is not really going to be relevant for plans and what they do in the future. Because, in fact, I think they'd rather just keep the money, and I think they figured it out now that they probably can do this without having a loss.
And how about the payments to private managed care plans or Medicare Advantage plans? Mm-hmm. How key do you think those are to what we've seen in the market?
You know, Judy alluded to this before. We saw what happened with the Balanced Budget Act of 1997, and then Congress said, we'd like more Medicare Advantage, or then Medicare Plus Choice plans, to be in rural areas. Let's set aside some money for those to come to rural areas. Well, they didn't come, and the money went away. And the consequence of that was a lot of plans said, we can't afford to do this at the current rate you're paying us. Consequently, we're going to get out of this market. And beneficiaries were furious if they lost the plan they were in. They felt betrayed. I think that there's a lot of truth to that. We've seen in the past year 2 million people enroll in Medicare Advantage plans that hadn't been there before, or maybe had been and came back to the program. And I think there is a lot of discussion on Capitol Hill whether or not they'll change how these payments are structured. I think that one interesting thing is that the drug benefit is very different. And so when Judy talks about using a model, for example, from the drug benefit side and changes, that's based on what the plan thinks the plan needs to offer the benefit. So this is what I'm going to need. This is what my bid is. The way that reimbursement works on the Medicare Advantage side is you have a floor based on a number of different payment streams. And it's very different, and in fact, a little bit uneven. You'll see benefits offered in Miami, Florida, for example, very different from the benefits that are offered in other parts of the country because of how those payment streams are enacted. So I would be surprised if Congress doesn't take a look at that, and how they change it will have a very big impact on whether or not these Medicare beneficiaries will be able to continue to enjoy the plans, because many beneficiaries love them, and whether or not they can continue to stay in them. So we'll see.
And Judy, what's your view? I mean, the growth in Medicare Advantage plans possibly as a result of some of the additional payments, I mean, is that a positive development?
I think that the reason the plans have increased is because there's good market. It makes sense for them financially, and if it didn't make sense, they will retrench as they did in the mid-1990s. I think the complexity of the program is not a benefit to beneficiaries, and my fear is that in addition, the additional costs that come to Medicare from having these private plans is part of why we will be told that we can't afford it as the likes of me come onto the program, me and the rest of the baby boomers. I mean, it's not a very good solution to the aging population to say, well, we can't afford to provide you Medicare coverage in the future. So I hope that we will look hard at all the costs associated with the program, honestly, and provide parity between the costs from the traditional program, which is just Medicare, and the private model. And if it costs 11% more to provide the traditional benefit in a private model, don't do it. Save that money. Bring it over to the benefit side. If it costs more to administer private models, don't pay for that. It's not fair to taxpayers, and it's not fair to the future health insurance needs of the aging Medicaid United States population. So I think it's not all in all been a benefit, adding stable benefits to beneficiaries. And as former CMS Administrator Bruce Vladeck said, it didn't save the program a nickel. And he brought Medicare Plus Choice in as an experiment to see if it would save money. So let's do a cost-effective, fair program for the future and look at all the costs involved.
Including the beneficiary portion, because one of the reasons it's been so popular is that some of these plans offer, you want simple, no coverage gap, no premium, small co-payments for prescriptions. That's pretty simple when you're looking at a beneficiary saying, hey, this is a great option. And, oh, by the way, how about some glasses? You need dental care? How about hearing aids? A lot of things that the traditional Medicare program doesn't provide. So it does offer I don't think Medicare beneficiaries are the same everywhere. And one of the benefits that we've seen that the market can bring, frankly, is that they don't treat beneficiaries as one size fits all. And that beneficiaries, my father is probably different from your mother, and there you go. And they may need different things, and this gives more responsibility, frankly, to the Medicare program and our partners to help explain some of these differences. But at the end of the day, it's not a surprise when satisfaction rates are 80% or higher, because we've really tailored the plans have been tailored to those beneficiaries' individual needs.
I'm not here as a tit for tat, and I don't want to do that. But Medicare is hugely successful, and people who have Medicare love Medicare. It's people who know the least about Medicare, who keep hearing how terrible it is. It's the best health insurance in the country, the biggest network in the country. The network is pretty much all doctors, all hospitals. A lot of our Medicare beneficiaries need nursing homes, all nursing homes, all home health agencies. It's a great health insurance program, despite the fact that it's needed advocacy, it has gaps. It needs dental coverage. It needs needed prescription drug. I don't think the way it's been provided, eyeglasses and hearing aids. Few managed care plans really offer good dental or hearing aid coverage. And all in all, Medicare has been tremendously successful, and the people who use it love it. So if that's the guide, I say back to the future. Medicare, qua Medicare, has been a tremendous success, easily understood, easily counseled, not necessarily one-on-one like Part D and the individual plans. And it's been something that we should savor and cherish and provide for the future.
Well, this is another debate I'm sure we'll be able to continue to have. We're coming to the end of the hour, and I want to make sure we give people a bit of a preview of what to expect over the next few weeks in the open enrollment period. And Juliet, let me start with you. You have a health affairs paper coming out next week looking at enrollment patterns in the Part D market this year, and I don't want to ask you to divulge any embargoed material, but give us a sense of how you expect enrollment to shake out in 2007.
Well, as of the end of the enrollment period in 2006, we had over 22 million people enrolled in Part D plans for this year. So, and Kaiser's own survey research shows that a majority of people say they're satisfied with their coverage, and if they had to choose again, they would choose the same plan. So I think it's a fair question whether people will actually want to go back to the drawing board and reevaluate their choice all over again, or whether they will kind of go with the path of least resistance and stay where they are. But I think based on what we've talked about in our own research into variation in coverage between 2006 and 2007, it really is important for people to assess coverage, and if they want to stay where they are, just understand how their coverage might be changing. So I'm not sure that we're going to see some really dramatic shifts in enrollment across plans.
And Judy, we talked a little bit earlier about the some of the glitches in the logistics last year and into early this year. What's your sense of how smoothly this process is going to go over the next few weeks?
Not. I have to say I'm extremely sympathetic to the task that's been put before CMS. I would not have designed the program to give them so much work. It's a yeoman's plus job to make this thing move smoothly. But one of the things I'm concerned about, for instance, is that people who enroll in a new plan are supposed to automatically be disenrolled from their current plan. And I hope that the systems will work smoothly with that. The old plan doesn't want to give them up. And they need to give the data smoothly to make that work. I hope that's not one of the major problems we'll see. I think Juliet's right. I think, unfortunately, that many people will stay where they are. I suspect that's what some of the large market share plans counted on from 2006. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of data movement that has to happen smoothly. New people coming on as dual eligibles, the movement from one plan to the other. I'm concerned that the systems won't be in place to make those things move as smoothly as we all would like. And that's something we have to figure out. How can we help make that happen more smoothly and be seen as true partners and not adversaries?
Well, Leslie, hopefully we've encouraged some people to enroll earlier in the month rather than later in the month.
Yeah, that's one important piece. Yeah. You know, I think the Wall Street Journal Harris did a poll last week or the week before, the number of beneficiaries who thought they'd switch, and I think their number was 12-13%, something in that range. So that's one indicator. We have the individuals who states may be taking another look, as they did in 2006, and making sure that they're dual eligibles or LIS, or if they're in an SPAP program, a state pharmaceutical assistance program, they too may be switching them. So we've asked or are asking the new governors or governors generally, as well as any state Medicaid directors or those who work with this population, to give us a heads up and let us know. A lot of the issues we had at the beginning of last year related to large-scale changes where the state and CMS perhaps didn't have the best data exchange. Some states we had no problem at all. States had great data. We were all set. Other states, we had pretty significant problems. And if we can head that off, those problems, I think that would be really helpful. So working with the states, and plus we've seen this before, so we're hoping that we've addressed the internal issues that we have. But sometimes the issue relates to data coming into CMS. So there's a lot that's going on, and I think we're far better prepared than we were last year. And I don't think it'll be perfect, but I do hope that, for example, the disenrollments and enrollments that I talked about before, people should only do one transaction. I'm concerned if someone does two transactions, that they disenroll one day and then enroll another day, that actually may be more problematic to ensure coverage in January. So remember, one transaction is the other piece to make it go smoothly. So.
And let me ask you get the last word here. Kind of stepping back and thinking about what the goals of Part D were and what you were trying to accomplish from CMS's perspective in the implementation, give us an assessment of what you think went well and what your biggest challenges are in the next round.
One of the goals we had were simply to make sure people knew and get people drug coverage. The fact that we ended up with 90%, not all Medicare covered, but covered either through that or through a retiree health plan or through some other program, government program or otherwise, that's really important. So really glad that we reached that goal. That other 10% is troublesome. Maybe they have no interest, who knows, but at least if they know and can understand. There is a subset of that group that concerns me, and those are those who qualify, we think, for the limited income subsidy, but we couldn't find them to sign them up. This year, we've allowed them to sign up year-round. We will be doing the exact same thing next year so that these beneficiaries, this plan is really designed to help them the most. They can get the most out of this, more than any other beneficiary, and so we really, really want to reach them. They're a very tough group to reach, regardless of the government program, and that's, I think, one of the things that we'll be continuing to address outside of open enrollment periods, much like we did this year, and we're working with a number of different groups to help us figure out how to reach them. Whether they've got issues with language or cultural competency, that we need to figure out how to speak their language. We need to figure out how to reach out to them. And that's one area where I think there will always be some room for improvement, but that's where our partners have been, I think, most helpful in finding and helping us find them and helping us understand how to reach them and reaching them together. So I think having a national discussion about drug benefits and having people and families sit down, hopefully they'll do so over Thanksgiving. It's a great time to spend some time with your loved ones, look at our plan finder, call us or work with a partner, whatever it happens to be. I think a lot of people came out and helped out each other. And Medicare, CMS, frankly, developed partnerships that we didn't know we had. We knew that we had folks like the Center for Medicare Advocacy out there helping beneficiaries, but there are all sorts of untraditional partners that we reached out to, as we say, where they live, work, play, and pray. And we hope to continue that, not only with this, but to make the entire Medicare program a better program as we go forward.
Well, I'm sure we could continue for several hours here, but unfortunately, we only have one. I'm Larry Levitt. You've been watching KaiserNetwork.org. Thanks to our panel of experts, and thanks to you for joining us. We'll see you next time for Ask the Experts.